I have a dream. One small step.
Oh, my, we say.
The wall must go.
China, Princess of Wales.
Right into the World Trade Center.
Winner is Sydney.
This week in history.
Well, for this week in history, we're going back to October the 15th, 1894, when a Jewish man named Alfred Dreyfus was arrested in France on the suspicion that he was a German spy. For the following 12 years, his case was debated passionately across France, with almost every citizen and newspaper having an opinion for or against Dreyfus before he was finally found innocent in 1906. The Dreyfus affair had huge and lasting consequences in France. It sealed the split between church and state. It saw the beginnings of a new form of anti-Semitism combined with nationalism in Europe. And it led some prominent Jews to argue for a Jewish homeland instead of striving for assimilation. So tonight we're exploring the Dreyfus affair with Professor Charles Sawin from the University of Melbourne, where he's an expert in French history, and he authored the book France Since 1870, which is in its third edition. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Take us back to 1894. Who was Alfred Dreyfus, and how did he come to be arrested on spying charges?
Dreyfus was a man from the province of Alsace, which the Prussians had retaken in the War of 1870-71. He had a passionate commitment to France. He moved to France and embarked on an army career. He was the first Jewish officer to rise so high as he did.
Right, but he was seen as a bit of an outsider in the army. Was this because he was Jewish?
Yeah, well, it's hard to say. I suppose that a Jew in the army had the problem that women sometimes had, that if he was seen to be too strident, too careful, too particular about things in his career, he was looked upon as not as much fun. Probably wasn't a glad hander. So being Jewish in the climate of anti-Semitism of the day was a further handicap.
And what was the attitudes in France like at the time towards Jewish people?
Well, anti-Semitism, of course, goes back 2,000 years, and the roots of much of the anti-Semitism are in the church's anti-Semitism. After all, the Gospels blame the Jews for the crucifixion of Jesus.
Yeah.
So you had that in a largely practicing Catholic country, which France still was at that time. You've got that. The church is very active in it. And there's a big wing of the church which fans anti-Semitism for other reasons. The newspaper The Cross, La Croix, which today is a very progressive social Catholic newspaper, in those days was violently anti-Semitic, and several religious orders were violently anti-Semitic. To the traditional anti-Semitism, a kind of quiet anti-Semitism, if you like, for the most part, in the society, you have added, after the 1870s and 80s, during an industrial takeoff in France, you get a lot of resentment against the people who are winning out, and some people turn to anti-Semitism, blaming the Jews for this,
right.
What Friedrich Engels famously called the socialism of fools. This kind of anti-Semitism gave rise to a major anti-Semitic newspaper, a daily newspaper, and a kind of tendency to for Jews to be blamed when things went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So you had, in addition to that general kind of snobbishness, you might say, in the officer corps, especially toward Jews, you had a popular movement of some significance, which was, frankly, anti-Semitic.
Okay. And you said he was a French patriot. So how did he come to be arrested as being a spy?
The story begins in the wastebasket of the German embassy in Paris. The French intelligence services, they were known as the statistics section, they had in their pay the cleaning lady, and she brought them the contents of the wastebasket every day. And one day in early October, the cleaning lady brought them a real piece of gold. It was an appendix to a letter listing a number of very valuable pieces of intelligence which were said to accompany the letter. So although they didn't have what had gone, they knew that the Germans had received a batch of things, including the secret file on the brand new rifle that the French were developing, and many other pieces of important evidence. So there was spying and treachery going on. The statistics section then looked to see who could have been the one that would have been able to get all the different documents. And they made an assumption. Things often go wrong at the start if you make the wrong assumption. They thought that the only person who could have got all those documents would be an officer in training, because the officers in training were circulated through various aspects of the service. And they would have had access to all those documents over a period of several months. Now, that wasn't true, as we will discover later. Someone else was using other methods to get those documents.
Right.
But that narrowed the field to 16 people.
Mm-hmm. And how did Alfred get chosen out of those 16?
Well, Alfred had negative reports, not faulting him, but saying that he was standoffish, that he was too severe and cold, and things like that. And the investigators formed a negative opinion of him, probably, of course, added to the fact that they knew he was Jewish. So given they had nothing else to go on, they decided to arrest Dreyfus.
Uh-huh. So they arrested him, and they had a case, and they said they had a case, and it was about to be dropped for lack of evidence because, as you said, it was about his standoffishness. There was no actually hard evidence about him. But then an anti-Semitic newspaper got involved. What happened?
Yeah, well, the case was collapsing. They not only had no evidence, but they had five handwriting experts trying to compare Dreyfus's handwriting to that of the document they'd got from the German embassy. And three of the five handwriting experts said it wasn't the same, and two were unsure. So, yes, they had a collapsing case, and they were about to release Dreyfus. Now, one of the daily newspapers at the time, known as the Free Word, La Libre Parole, got wind of this, probably from an anti-Semitic officer who knew of the business, and they published a front-page story saying that the Jewish lobby was about to effect the release of a traitor that had been captured. And that really tipped the scales, because the thought of arousing all this antipathy from this anti-Semitic base, if you like, really scared the statistics section and the Ministry of War. They didn't want that sort of thing. So they decided to proceed with a case against him. But they had a big problem, which was that they didn't have evidence. And under the political pressure that they were now feeling, they came up with, well, two solutions to the lack of evidence. One solution was forgery. They took a letter they had in their files, which was from a German to an Italian officer, speaking of that scoundrel D. It wasn't about Dreyfus at all, but the letter D was Dreyfus's first name, so they put that into the file.
Oh, my gosh.
And then they forged another document. That document, they simply added an incriminating phrase to it in their own handwriting. You couldn't have got away with that today. And,
right,
in fact, at the time, you couldn't have got away with it if it had been shown to the court in open session and people had examined it.
Right. So some very dodgy practices, basically.
Yes. And the other dodgy practice was that they decided to do a kind of smear of Dreyfus by inserting gratuitously 47 hot love letters between the Italian and German military attachés. They were having a hot affair. One of the letters, this is typical of the tone of the letters, reads in part, "Yes, yes, my little red dog, I will come to give you pleasure. I would be capable of stuffing a meter of tongue in you and in all the commanders of the 14 armies."
Oh, my gosh.
So there were 47 of these letters. They would make a wonderful anthology for a porn show.
Yeah.
And they were put in the same file.
But what have they got to do with Dreyfus?
Ah, well, you might ask. Nothing. Dreyfus was a devoted patriot. He was independently wealthy. He didn't need German money. And he was known as a very conservative, very straight family man. He had no mistresses, no affairs of any sort, and there was nothing on record for them to see on that. But at the time, in a period of economic transition, in some ways like the period we're going through today, it's easy to feed suspicion. And homosexuals and general notions of decadence were a big issue for conservatives at the time. Notions that France was in decline, that men were getting effeminate, that women no longer behaved like women, and that we were besieged by homosexuals. These kinds of notions were current in the conservative sector of public opinion. And the people in the intelligence section knew that these would trouble the judges and might in some ways help smear Dreyfus, even though they didn't even try to make a connection.
But they weren't about him. Oh, my God. Unbelievable.
They weren't about him.
Okay.
So they stuffed the 47 love letters and the two forgeries into a sealed envelope, and they said that on grounds of national security, it was too sensitive to be shown to the court, that only the judge could see it.
Uh-huh.
The judges, there were three, went off and closeted themselves and read these documents, and they were very upset. This was not on their radar, and that probably was part of the effect that they intended with those 47 love letters.
Okay.
So that's what made it possible to find Dreyfus guilty.
Right.
The forgeries, if the forgeries had been true, there would have been some evidence.
Uh-huh.
And if the defense had had a chance to examine them, it would have been easy to show them up by scrutiny as forgeries, even with the tools of the day.
You're on Nightlife, and we're talking about the Dreyfus affair, which started in 1894 when Alfred Dreyfus was arrested on suspicion he was a German spy. He was found guilty. We're talking to Professor Charles Sauerwein from University of Melbourne. So he was found guilty. What were the scenes like when the army court-martial made that ruling, and what sentence was he given?
He was sentenced to life imprisonment on an island off the coast of South America, Devil's Island, it was known, a horrible place.
Of South America?
Yes, well, there's a French, what was then a colony, which is now a department of France, French Guiana. And so he was imprisoned on Devil's Island, this little pile of rock outside of that colony. It was French territory. But before he was taken to the courtyard of the Palace of the Invalides in Paris, which is the headquarters of the army, and publicly degraded so that his insignia were torn off and his sword was broken, and he was generally humiliated to a howling crowd.
Right.
And it was that scene which meant that some of the observers, including the Theodor Herzl, who was the founder of Zionism, led them to think that if in such the most progressive country in Europe, if this could happen to a Jew, then they had to find a homeland for Jews elsewhere.
Right, that's what led, and then we get the modern state of Israel. So he's sent to this rocky outcrop, he's publicly disgraced, and, you know, Jewish people are sent a very clear message by this. But the spying went on. So what happened when they realised the spying's still going on and began to investigate?
Yes, I should also mention that people began to have doubts because the case seemed so flimsy from the outside, since people had not seen that sealed file. And so there was pressure building on the other side. And in that context, the government proceeded, well, they had to, because they found that the leaks were still occurring. And a Lieutenant Colonel George Picard was the investigator who found the true culprit. There was a traitor. He was Major Ferdinand Esterhazy. That was a famous Eastern European dynasty, the Esterhazys. But this was a fairly shady and impoverished descendant of theirs who lived on gambling and blackmail. And
right.
was a pretty shady character.
And he was the culprit.
He was the culprit. And once Picard got on his trail, he had a mountain of evidence. There was no doubt about it. So he started to pursue that path. But the politics of it came into play here. The Minister of War at this point had staked his reputation on Dreyfus being guilty, and he simply did not want another culprit to complicate things. So he sent Picard to a very backwater provincial post to get him out of Paris and prevent him from continuing.
Right.
And he then suggested quietly to another officer of the intelligence service that he needed more evidence. And this officer started new forgeries. And this one does tie in those love letters. They had more of those love letters. These guys were really, really at it. They had more of those letters, and he took one from the Italian military attaché to his German lover, in which he invited him to dinner with three friends from my embassy, including one Jew. And then, with a razor blade, Colonel Henry cut the letter apart and pasted in similar paper on which he wrote himself words which made it seem that Dreyfus was that Jew who was invited to the dinner.
Totally set up. So the corruption went on after he was even exiled, just to put the case away from the true culprit. Did they ever put Esterhazy on trial, the true culprit?
Yes, but they let him off.
Because of all this stuff that was still going on with Dreyfus.
Yeah, they at that point the judges felt if they convicted him, it would mean that Dreyfus was innocent, and that was by
they
that point they were
that.
All they were all so far into it that they didn't want to do that. But it had the other effect that Picard began to think that he might be assassinated or otherwise disposed of, and so he confided everything to a very senior statesman of the Republic and told him to tell the truth if anything happened to him.
Right.
So you now have a kind of things ready to go off at that point.
And so when did the famous French writer Emile Zola get involved, and what did he do?
Well, he comes right back at the point we were talking about where the true culprit, Esterhazy, is acquitted. Zola was so incensed by this that he wrote a famous open letter to the President of the Republic, which the editor of one of the Republican newspapers, Georges Clemenceau, later the famous wartime premier of France, published on the front page of the newspaper and gave it the famous title, J'accuse, I accuse. And it was a systematic accusation, mostly of all the cover-ups, all the people who'd covered it, all the military officers by name, all the politicians. He was daring them to sue him for libel.
Mm-hmm. And that's how we had that phrase, and now you may have heard that before, now you know where it comes from. So he was accused of libel, and then that made this a big international affair. So he fled to England. Did he keep agitating from there?
He did, in the sense that he continued his writings. In a sense, it had taken off by that point beyond any need for him to stir the pot more. His J'accuse had already been the biggest selling pamphlet of the entire Dreyfus affair. It sold 300,000 copies in the first day, although you have to say that many of the anti-Semitic tracts sold as much at other times.
Mm.
But it was still the biggest sale in the first day for any of the tracts, and it continued to attract a lot of attention. On both sides of the divide now, because you do have a divide, people are redouble their efforts. So you have the formation of an anti-Semitic league, which recruits thugs to go and bash Jews and intellectuals and leftists. You have riots, some very major riots, particularly in Algiers, of European settlers against Jews. You have in some of the provincial cities of Paris, you have riots. You could almost call them pogroms.
Mm.
The Catholic newspaper La Croix went completely over the top and every day talked about the need to smash Jewish omnipotence and boot the Jew out of France. So you have a huge energy going there. But, of course, you've got now a big collection of people around Republicans and socialists who see this as a threat to the Republic. If you can't have justice for an individual, then how can you have a true republic? So you have a large coalition which gradually, of course, outweighs the other side, but it takes quite a while. That coalition begins, of course, with Clemenceau. It begins with the great socialist leader Jean Jaurès, who proves in a series of speeches to Parliament that the proofs have to be forgeries because they don't make sense otherwise.
Right.
You have a whole series of leaders who participate in this and create the League of the Rights of Man, as it's still known today, which is the foremost organization for civil liberties in France. And they begin to prosecute the case.
This is massive because, I mean, it's a time of great division, but you can see where so many things have come out of this in terms of human rights protections. And also, I suppose, the split between the Catholic Church and the French Republic.
Essentially, the Republicans lose the elections of 1898, but gradually build up a big base by the next elections in 1902. And at that point, you have a new government which is determined to bring an end to the affair. And they now see the church, of course, as a major source of unrest in the country.
Right.
So,
So they did a retrial, but he was still found guilty again, even after all of that.
He was found guilty with extenuating circumstances, whatever that means, and no one knew at the time what it meant.
Right.
The judges seem to have thought that they could not lose face by finding him innocent, find him guilty, but make it possible to commute his sentence by saying there were extenuating circumstances. But Dreyfus, who was a very proud man, a man of great integrity, would have nothing of that. He was not going to accept that. The case continued, and the end result, of course, was that finally in 1906, Dreyfus was pardoned and then retried or by administrative trial, really, and found innocent and reinstated in the army. In the meantime, that new majority of Republicans began the separation of church and state. The Catholic Church had been brought into the state by Napoleon and had signed a concordat in 1804, which made the Catholic Church an organ of the French state and made France a Catholic country.
Okay.
The Republicans had always been uncomfortable with this, particularly after the church's turn to the right. In 1864, the Pope issued an encyclical with a syllabus of errors, arguing against democracy, liberalism, secularism, and ending with the famous sentence that it was an error that the sovereign pontiff can or should ever reconcile himself to progress, liberalism, and modern civilization.
So I suppose that is the longer-term consequences of the Dreyfus affair, this formalizing of the separation of church and state in France, which is particularly strict on this compared to other countries. But what about its contribution to the rise of a really nationalistic form of anti-Semitism?
Well, that's a very good point. I like to say, perhaps a bit jokingly, that the French don't get enough credit for fascism. It's looked on as a fairly German or possibly Italian, and it really should be looked on as Italian because it's Mussolini who really invents fascism, coins the term. But the French bring together anti-Semitism with nationalism, authoritarianism, and resentment against the new wealth in the society. So that mix becomes a potent force in France, and, of course, it influences people in Germany. It influences Houston Stuart Chamberlain, the Englishman who was so influential on Hitler. And, in fact, one of the organizations of the right that emerges from the Dreyfus affair is the ancestor of today's National Front. So there's a straight continuity on both sides of politics.
Wow.
The Dreyfus affair coalesced, brought together, if you like, the values which would characterize what in the 20th century would be known as the left, values of individual justice, the republic, a measure of social justice, and it also brought together the values of authoritarianism, nationalism, anti-Semitism, which would characterize the 20th century right. And those forces are still at work today.
Indeed. So, Professor Sawan, in the end, the former French president Jacques Chirac made a formal apology to the descendants of Dreyfus and of the writer Zola. How much controversy and high feeling and ill feeling, I suppose, still remains about this case more than a century later?
Well, about the case, not very much. The National Front and most of the other anti-Semitic forces in France had moved to support Israel, and Muslims have replaced Jews as their scapegoats. Jews, on the other hand, are no longer necessarily in the forefront of the left and the Republicans. So there was not that much controversy, and it was interesting that Chirac, a conservative president, was the one who did it. And he did it very well.
Mm.
It was a very, very moving apology. So I think that the Dreyfus affair has been put to rest, if one can put an affair to rest. What, of course, we are now dealing with is, in this new world, a new kind of anti-Semitism in France, which is in some different in some ways, but still problematic.
Well, you can see so many implications for today. And it seems like we live in a time of heightened tension, almost fake news, like that they were going through then. I can see a lot of parallels with the time today as well, I think.
Well, it was. It was a time of fake news, and it was a time the French pioneered the big press runs. The French newspaper was the first in the world to reach 1 million copies sold a day in 1890.
Oh.
And it was that huge new press that made possible the affair, which reached down to every person. We know from diaries and things that there's no family that escaped it. It was a thing that would, you know, famously caused people to throw plates at dinner parties all the time. The press was in many ways based on a lot of fake news, or when they couldn't find real news that was salacious enough to sell the kinds of numbers they were looking to sell.
Yeah.
So France pioneered this, the mass media and stretching of the truth,
and with
the tabloid press.
Right. And with those letters, they didn't need the page three girl.
Well, the letters only came out about 10 years ago.
Right.
Okay. It was a guy writing a history of homosexuality in France who discovered them. They had not been, people had opened that file but had seen that the letters were irrelevant and didn't think to pursue the issue further. So although the archives had been opened, nobody stopped and thought, what did it mean?
Well, thank you for having our juiciest moment of This Week in History. I think we've done since the entire segment was invented more than a year and a half ago. That was definitely it.
Thank you so
thanks so much for your time tonight about telling us about the Dreyfus affair. It's been great to chat to you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Professor Charles Sauerein has been my guest from the University of Melbourne. He's an expert in modern French history and the author of France Since 1870.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife. Yeah.